Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're joining us today. Of course, for most of you, you probably know this. We're now getting into our third year of doing this again. We're so glad that Central Coast Voices could come back on KCBX, and we're glad that you're here with us today. Our goal is to bring you credible, valid information and insights about diverse people in our community and what they're doing. Central Coast of Voices wants to address how today's choices really affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of things we do in our everyday life and how it affects society. As you know, this is a community radio station. This is public radio KCBX, and we're glad you're part of that public radio community. And part of what we do is presenting programs like this is make sure we can do our very best to make you part of the dialogue also, which is my way of telling you and reminding you that this is a call-in program. The phone number to call in is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. And I would encourage you to do the following, and that is first call in, but call in early. It is interesting that we find people who want to wait until about 8 or 9 minutes before the program's about to end, and they want to call in, and oftentimes they're then frustrated by the fact that we can't really work with them as much as we want to make sure we get to be part of the conversation. So don't be one of those folks. Give us a call early if you're interested in talking with us. And today we have a fascinating topic, and we're going to talk with an organization called Hands in Nepal. And about 7 years ago, a young 19-year-old fellow named Danny Chafin was volunteering at an orphanage in Kathmandu. And one of the things that came to his attention was that the key factor for almost all the children he was dealing with was a way to get an education. And we're going to talk today with a number of folks involved with that. And that's really what this is all about. I do want to remind you that Central Coast Voices is a project of Action for Healthy Communities. We basically provide a study every 3 years, or Action for Healthy Communities does, that is, looking at the outcomes and trends in the county with regard to our health, welfare, overall well-being, and things that are going on in the county, both economic, educationally, health-wise, and we want you to be part of that discussion. Also, you can find more information at www.actionslo.org. There is a full report which you can look at and or download portions of, and it'll give you a handle on what's going on the Central Coast and what things that are going on that may affect you and may affect your community. Well, certainly affect your community, but may affect people who are close to you also. This is one of those programs that I love to do, and we don't get an opportunity to do very often. You would think that the connection between Santa Margarita and Nepal would not be a real close connection. I don't know. There may be communities in Nepal that are like Santa Margarita, and Santa Margarita might be the same. But that's not necessarily always the case. And it came to our attention that there's a wonderful organization called Hands in Nepal. And today we have Jan Sprague Chafin and Holly Naylor. And Jan is she's a elementary school teacher by day, and she does that as a full-time job. And then she also takes on a tremendous effort on the in the case of Hands in Nepal. Holly Naylor is a retired middle school teacher, and she's on the board of Hands in Nepal. And she's also been in the field with the organization a lot. We'll be joined a little bit later on this afternoon by Jake Peters. Jake doesn't live locally, but we'll hear about what his connection is to the local folks that are involved in Hands in Nepal. But he has just recently returned from some of his work with the organization. And we can probably stop beating around the bush and just say that we need to find out what in the world Hands in Nepal is and how in the world Santa Margarita ever got involved with that. So, Jan, I'll start with you. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Fred.
And thanks for being here today.
My pleasure.
So your son, mm-hmm. Danny, mm-hmm. was a volunteer in Kathmandu at age of 19.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And somehow this all grew out of that.
It did. He was a beginning college student here on the Central Coast who suddenly realized he wasn't quite sure what he wanted to major in and what university he really wanted to dedicate his time and life energy to. So we suggested that he try volunteering. Of course, we didn't think he'd pick a place as far away as Nepal, and we weren't really sure exactly where Nepal was when I came home from work one day, and he suddenly said, I found where I'm going to volunteer, and it's in Kathmandu. And he had been doing some research online and found an orphanage there called Buddhist Child Home. And one of the reasons he picked that place and Kathmandu was he was looking at a variety of places that advertised for students to volunteer at. And I'm sure everybody's familiar. There's a lot of organizations out there for you to go help them and volunteer, but they charge a considerable sum of money for that, you know, opportunity to volunteer. Well, Danny found this orphanage pretty much was, we need your help. Come, you know, just come and help us. And it didn't cost thousands of dollars for him to go overseas and do that. The downside, or actually turned out to be the upside, was he had to find his own accommodations and make his own way around Kathmandu. There wasn't any real structured organization there to receive him. And he ended up living with the lady who ran the orphanage and quickly made a lot of friends, both the children that attended this orphanage of 50-some kids, and then people in the neighborhood and friends with the family he was living with, too. And that's how he became really familiar with the culture of Nepal and was able to get down into a grassroots level of why there was such a need for education and why there were so many homeless children on the streets and why there were so many orphanages just in Kathmandu alone.
Well, I need to interject then. You need to explain maybe why there are indeed a lot of homeless children or orphanages in a community.
Well, one thing he found out after he was there for several weeks was that many of the children at the orphanage were not even orphans, but were children who were taken off the streets by the police or taken out of hotels where they were, I don't want to say enslaved, they're actually, they say, indentured servants. So these are children who, for one reason or another, have been placed into the labor force at a very early age. And then it's not legal in Nepal to do that, even though it is a growing crisis there, as in other Asian countries. So the police once in a while will raid a place like a hotel. They will take children from the basements where they usually are doing laundry, or the back rooms of kitchens where they're washing dishes, and then they put them in orphanages because they don't know who the parents are. Oftentimes, these children have been living on the streets, and Danny soon began to learn that the orphanage is not the bottom of the barrel for these kids. They're actually removed several times up in their stations of life and have a couple of square meals a day, clothes, and in some cases are getting an education if the orphanage can provide that.
So are some of the children... Do they have some of the children's parents feel like maybe by allowing their child to appear to be an orphan or to send their child off to be an indentured servant as a starting point may be the way that they'll end up with a better life than what their parents have?
Well, I think that last part you said is the underlying truth. You know, I've been to Nepal many times, and when my son went over there, I let him stay a month or so before I soon went over to check on him. I was really concerned about him living in this very foreign, faraway place that was one of the poorest countries in the world. And communication with Danny back then was sketchy. Nepal has a real problem with electricity, and at that time there wasn't very much internet. But when I did go over there as an educator myself, I began to ask, you know, what's going on with all these street kids and kids in the orphanages? And through translators, found out that parents, like parents everywhere, love their children dearly. They don't want to give them up. They do so only out of the most desperate situations. There's many people in the villages of Nepal up in the hills who've never been to Kathmandu. So it becomes like this mythical land of Oz to them, where if they can get their children down there, they'll get an education, they'll get a job, they'll be able to send money back to the villages. And having never been in Kathmandu themselves, they have no idea what a teeming mess of a third world city it is, and a very difficult maze for children coming down out of a village to negotiate through.
So this is, I mean, in the 18th century, we talked, rural people in America talked about getting, you know, being able to move to Chicago mm-hmm. or move to St. Louis because that was the center of the universe to them. So that's still a perception in Nepal as to what the large mythical city is and what the opportunities it must have for everyone in their mind.
Well, it has been. I think in more recent years, people are getting more exposed to what's going on politically in Nepal and around the world because the internet has finally arrived. But 7 years ago, when Danny was first over there, you have to realize Nepal was coming out of a very bloody civil war. They had been fighting politically against communist Maoists and the Nepal Democratic Party in a really unstable situation where the Maoists were going up into the hills and the villages and telling the villagers, we'll bring you roads, schools, clinics, and we'll be able to employ not just the men but the women too if you join our party. This caused a lot of fighting up in the hills. A lot of people lost their lives. I've heard statistics as high as 15,000 people killed, a lot of displaced children. So, going down to Kathmandu seemed like a safer haven at times when the civil war was raging up around the Himalayas. And sending your children down to Kathmandu seemed like a more secure, safe place for children to go than being up in these villages where there is very little infrastructure, very few schools, and this, you know, fighting going on from village to village.
Yeah. I want to remind you all that this is Central Coast Voices, and we're talking today about a fascinating local organization based in, of all places, Santa Margarita, California, Hands in Nepal, talking about the education of children and building schools in Nepal. And we'll get on with the discussion in a moment. I want to remind you also that this is a call-in program. We would love you to be part of the discussion, either with your questions, concerns, or observations. You can give us a call at 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. This is Community Public Radio, and you are part of the community, and we'd like you to be part of the discussion. Holly, how did you get involved in this? I mean, let me back up for a second. First off, and I mentioned earlier, both of you are school teachers. You're a retired school teacher. Jan is still teaching school. I don't know where she finds time as a school teacher to do all of this, too. But how did you get involved in this?
I've been interested in international education for many years. I taught in Tehran, Iran, and Isfahan, Iran in the 1970s, and then later became involved with the U.S. University of Santa Barbara, their Middle Eastern studies. And through those experiences, going to Cairo with the Santa Barbara people, we studied girls' education in Egypt and the importance of, you know, keeping their education going beyond a third grade level. And those schools were supported by USAID or various different NGOs. And so about a year ago, I was talking to Lee Levick, a friend of ours, who said she was going to Kathmandu. And I said, I always wanted to go to Kathmandu. And I had been to a couple of the Hands in Nepal fundraisers previous years. And when she said she was going with Jan, it was like golden opportunity. Mm-hmm. Not only, I don't like to travel as a tourist, I like to travel as an educator. And so this was a golden opportunity and I could not pass up. And 2 weeks later, I was on a plane to Nepal.
Yeah. And it's an interesting concept because I can certainly understand and identify with the concept of I want to be a participant, I don't want to be a spectator. And I think that's important and we're hearing a lot about that. A few weeks ago, we had a program that was talking about in San Luis Obispo County how people can come here as tourists, if you will, but also get involved in issues of like the land conservancy and beach cleanup and things like that, because there indeed are more people who are looking at the transition from being tourists to being more of participants in the societies they go to. So let's probably clarify one of the questions that is probably on everybody's mind, and that is, what's Danny doing now? Because you told me he's on the board of the organization, but he's not living locally anymore. So
yeah.
How did that evolve?
Well, Danny, you know, he started his work in Nepal, left the orphanage, built a school up in the hills after friends asked him to come up and see what the real Nepal is like up in the hills. And also we're telling him how difficult it is for children in villages to attend school. So he through a friend, built the first school, then a second school, then a library, then another library. Meanwhile, he needed to get on with his college education. So he was coming back to the U.S. and attending Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado, where he was a peace major. He felt majoring in peace went right along with his work in Nepal, and was something he hoped to continue.
There are not many universities that have a major in peace.
There are not, but Naropa is an exceptional university. I love Naropa. I'm really happy to have supported Naropa through my son's education. And I understand Berkeley also has a peace major now, but it is a legitimate Bachelor of Arts in Peace. And that's where he met his fiancée, Bree Hugens, who was also in the Peace Department, and she had done some traveling around Nicaragua and worked with children there. So she was really interested in what Danny was doing in Nepal. The two of them ended up going back to Nepal and overseeing a school building, and now they have settled in Tucson, Arizona, where they're both working for a nonprofit known as Free the Children. They're out of Canada. And, you know, basically Danny had to get a job that paid, and working for Hands in Nepal does not pay. We're all doing this, you know, out of our own passion for the work we do for some of the poorest children on earth. And Danny's heart will always be in Nepal. He has some really good friends over there. And everyone's always asking, when is Danny coming back? Danny Sir, they call him. but he's a young man with a young wife, and they're trying to start their future with a paycheck and a wing and a prayer.
Yeah. Well, this is a wonderful opportunity that he's given you
great.
This. How many trips have you made to Nepal now?
Oof. I think I've made about 12, because some years I've gone over twice a year. And, you know, that's one thing that we try to do with our projects. We try to keep our hands literally involved in what we're doing over there. We have people that we trust, and we have them overseeing our projects when we're not there. But we do come back and check and visit the schools over and over again. And we always say you can literally put your hands on the wall of the school you helped to support and build. And we also...
How many schools have you built now?
We have done two schools plus a remodeling, a middle school, which we just finished. It was melting into the ground. Most of the schools in Nepal are made with adobe. You know, it's mud and rock construction because there isn't much of a forest left in the Himalayas. And then we go to the extra expense of plastering the walls to make them as sturdy as we can. And then we began doing libraries because we realized in the second village we worked in that they had no concept of what a library was. And we were so excited to turn them on to a library. You know, it's a building that houses books and everybody gets to go there and use them, even the adults. And so this became a real passion of mine to try to add a library in every village we went into. And then we started to show villages how you can use the libraries for things other than just book loaning. You can use it as a community room, as a place for meetings, all sorts of things.
What's the level of literacy in Nepal generally?
It's got one of the lowest literacy rates of most of the nations in the world, last time I checked. And I don't know the exact percentages. Do you, Holly, have any idea?
I don't know.
I do know that most of the people I work with in the villages... do not read or write. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that's really continued to fuel my passion. Kind-hearted, incredibly street-smart people, and who can, you know, show you how to train a water buffalo and plow a rice field and feed your family. But when it comes to reading and writing, they understand how important that is for their children. And I have a family, a Tibetan family I stay with when I'm there. And several of the people in this family are also illiterate. So traveling around with them and experiencing what that's like has really been an eye-opener for me. You know, we just take it for granted that we're going to learn how to read in this country. But when you go to a poor country where most of the population hasn't had that opportunity because they've had to work from the age of three, you just realize what a gift it is to give to them.
Well, So here's a way that we need to probably – a question we have to address reasonably early mm-hmm. in this discussion then. If literacy is low and there's not a lot of money to build schools, so organizations like Hands in Nepal are building schools, where do the teachers come from and how does the education evolve? I mean, a building is a building unless you can put a teacher in it.
Sure. And that's often a common question asked of us. We do have people that we find in villages who have had maybe as high as a high school education. Mm-hmm. They've been to Kathmandu, they've come back to the village, but they don't have an opportunity to use that. So we have had situations where we've been able to pay for teachers. Mm-hmm. Teacher pay in Nepal averages about $50 a month, U.S., so that's entirely doable to raise money to pay a teacher. We also have villages try to meet and talk about that themselves. You know, how can they get a government teacher to come up? There are government teachers, and they are available to teach if they're going to get paid. Part of the problem in a country like Nepal with its poor infrastructure and lack of support from the government is people who are trained teachers have to go off and do other work. But it's like if you build a school, they will come. And we've found
that
if we build
a
school, suddenly there's teachers and there's other people in the villages who have enough of an education to help out.
Yeah, I want to remind you, this is Central Coast Voices, and we're talking today with two wonderful teachers, one retired, one who's still a classroom teacher, so I don't know how she has time to do this, talking about a program that they have been involved in because Jan's son pretty much got the ball rolling with Hands in Nepal. And you're welcome to give us a call at 781-3875. We'd like you to be part of the discussion. And I'm pleased to say that let me pull it up here, okay? Jake, are you there?
Hi.
We've got Jake Peters on the phone. Jake does not live locally, but he is a volunteer for Hands in Nepal. And he's chosen to take some time today to be part of our discussion because we'd like to have an idea of I guess, what the motivation is to somehow get involved in a project like this. So take it away.
Okay, yeah. Well, I was motivated by the lack of support and lack of presence for education in these rural villages of Nepal, where you can go up to the foothills of the Himalayas and there's kids that are eager to learn, but there's no infrastructure there. So I decided to go over there and see what I could do to help.
And how did you find out about this in the first place?
Well, it started out with a family NGO. Danny is my cousin, so I've been kind of involved as it's developed and watched it grow. And after I graduated from college, it was kind of right up my alleyway with international development. So I decided to put my talents to good use.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you've been to Nepal. You just got back recently?
Yeah, I just got back in December, second week of December.
Was this your first trip, or how many times have you been over there?
Yeah, this is my first time going. I was there for 5 weeks, visited the different villages and different projects of Hands in Nepal, mm-hmm. and checked in on them and see how they're doing and set up hopefully a potential project for 2015.
Okay. So, yeah, I use the word startling. I would assume it's probably a startling experience to come from California to a place like Nepal, and and you were obviously briefed beforehand as to what to expect and what you were going into, but it was, I would say, probably at least an unusual environment to just step into.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. I mean, you can prepare and read and research all you want, but actually being there just opens your eyes to what it's really like, from stepping out of their airport into chaotic Kathmandu to getting into the villages and seeing the majestic hills and nature and the diverse people. You know, it's a thing that you really have to experience yourself, you know.
Is there a skepticism towards what Westerners bring to their community, or is it a, or do they know what Westerners are bringing to their community?
I'd say there's a bit of a skepticism, but they're very welcoming over there. It's part of the culture to be very hospitable. So they just need help, you know. So they want help any way that they can get it, but it's definitely, you have to do it through the certain cultural relativity avenues that exist within Nepal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I want to know, because I'm curious, what background you bring to this. What is your day job, and how did you evolve into tying this into it? I mean, you obviously had to take time off from work to go do this.
Yeah. No, I graduated from Cal State San Marcos down here in Southern California with a degree in international law and human rights. So it deals with, I studied extensively about the impact of poverty and lack of infrastructure that affects human rights and the natural human rights and whatnot. And just wrote about that through research and
Well, it's a fascinating way to stretch. One of the things that those of us who are, in my case, older than 60, kind of scratch our heads about is there seems to be the millennial generation seems to be rather self-absorbed. So hearing about young people who are getting into things like this and looking at it is very important, because for some of us, we have wondered whether or not me has become more important than us. So I thank you from that standpoint. You have a family connection to this, but what was your first reaction? Did you talk to Danny when he first got off of his trip, or and how did that get presented?
Yeah, no, I've discussed it with Jan and Danny throughout the fruition of the project. Mm-hmm. I've always followed the blogs and discussed it with them in person and the ongoings of Hands in Nepal.
Mm-hmm.
This opportunity just came up afterwards because they needed someone to go check in on all the projects, and I just kind of brought my interest from hearing and helping around local within the States to Nepal, and I decided to go for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if I could just interject something. One reason why we really wanted Jake to go is, I love the idea that Hands in Nepal started as a family-based project, grew into our local community. We are tremendously supported by our friends in Little Santa Margarita and then the greater outlying San Luis Obispo area. Every year they come to our benefits. But, you know, this opportunity to give young people like Jake, who are coming out of the universities with lots of good ideas on how to make the world a better place, I'd love to see Hands in Nepal as a springboard for people like Jake. You know, like, here's a great chance. We can't pay you, but, you know, we'll do our best to help with your expenses. Please go over and check on our projects, see what books they need, see what furniture needs to be built. Also, please see what communities can use a school. in the future, too. And there are people like Jake are young and athletic and able to go up and down the hills of the Himalayas. Jake was telling me how he walked from the floor, the valley floor of Pokhara, up to Astam, and Holly will be impressed by that.
Holly just rolled her eyes.
We took a Jeep. Yes, okay. We took a Jeep, but he hiked all the way up. And hiked all around that area. So, yeah, let's hear it for the youth of today and people like Danny and Jake.
Yeah. Jake, can you hold on with us for a few minutes, or are you running out of – you got some time to stay with us for a while?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. We have another call I want to get to here. See, is it Jim?
Yes, hello.
Okay, Jim, it says you're in Florida, so I'm assuming you're listening to us on the Internet, which, by the way, folks, you can listen to this streaming at kcbx.org. Jim, what are your thoughts here?
Well, I'm Jan's brother.
Oh, okay. So
hi,
this is a family project. Okay, go ahead.
It's very family, very close-knit, friends and neighbors. And I told Jan I was going to call up and heckle her today.
Oh.
Okay. Needed some hecklers to make it realistic, but far from it. I just want to say it's hard for anyone to realize the scope and extent of this small organization. Yet they're tightly knit. In the family, I'm known as the computer spreadsheet guy, because I go way back near the beginning of computers, and they always call me to do spreadsheets and comparisons, and I've been working on one for some time, and I'm not done yet, just to try to correlate the scope and complexity of all of the schools and libraries and places and names and geography. You know, foreign terms, English terms, and it's just amazing what they have done. So I'm still working on that. The point is, it's very extensive, and any support that anyone can give is very warranted. All of their donations go 100% to their projects. And the last thought is, people say, why go to Nepal? We have trouble here at home. But to do good in the world, we can work on many levels all over the world. And Nepal is one of the poorest and yet the most beautiful. So to help them over there, get some basic education, get women and children off the street, is a great benefit to the world in the long run. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Thanks
for the
Jim.
Call, Jim. Okay.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Okay. So how many of your relatives are we going to hear from today, Jen?
I think that's all.
Okay.
My brother's been tremendously supportive. And this has been a, you know, it started with one person, my son, and then I joined in. And then, you know, people in our family thought it was great. So in the community, and now we have a family in Minnesota that donates on an annual basis that just love what we're doing because their son went on a trek up in the Himalayas and came home and also saw the need for schools. They Googled building schools in Nepal and got our website and started to talk to us. Well, they were impressed that, you know, if you contact us, you will talk to us directly, not to a secretary or administrator. And we pretty laid out clearly to them what you need to do to build a school in Nepal and then encouraged them to come over with us. So they were very impressed that we didn't just want them to write out a check and that they could go visit the school they actually helped to build.
One of the things that when I looked at the information that you shared with me as we were preparing for the program is that it's not expensive to do.
It's not.
It's still a substantial amount of money, but right. For what it is, it's not expensive.
And it's a substantial amount of money in Nepal if you do the currency in Nepali rupees, you know, then you're talking 5,000 U.S., you know, can be tens of thousands of Nepali rupees. So it's you have to keep things in perspective. But compared to what it costs to build a school here in the U.S., yeah, it's
so a three or
totally
four
doable.
Room school there is about six or seven thousand U.S. dollars to
right.
do.
Right. Yeah, to do a really beautiful school with a nice tin roof, and tin is preferred because it is a earthquake prone country. And to have, you know, the good plaster and a cement floor and whiteboards, and to have furniture in the school too, which has to be built because we don't have IKEAs in Nepal. So everything is custom built and hauled up there, usually on the backs of porters. Something else a lot of people don't realize, and I think Jake can really relate to this, is there are very few roads up to these areas. So there's a lot of trails, and there's a real industry in being a porter and hauling stuff up on your back, you know, with the sweat of your brow. And we've had tin hauled up. We've had plaster hauled up, all kinds of building materials that had to be hauled up either on porter's back or on the back of mules. That's how they get supplies up there. Yeah.
Jake, was it a lot of hard work?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was lots of walking up and down. They say that Nepal, there's no such thing as flat. It's always up and down in Nepal. So, the people who haul the equipment up to these locations to build these skulls are just amazing. I have no idea how they do it. It's miraculous, really.
Well, that brings up an interesting question. You talk about about hauling things up, because one of the things that I think comes up that's probably a common question you get is we all think what we know most about Nepal and the Himalayas is Mount Everest,
right?
And the Sherpas that basically make their living getting people up and down the hill. And there's been some inference that that's a rather lucrative business to be in. So
right.
Why isn't there more money, I guess, is probably a question you get often.
You know, Nepal is a country of villages and castes, and there are that's one reason why they're having so much trouble today forming a constitution. They still don't have a constitution at the end of their civil war and trying to form their new government, because there's so many castes up in these villages, and Sherpa is a caste. You're born into the Sherpa caste. You don't choose that as an occupation. The Sherpas are Nepalis who live up near the border of Tibet in the Himalayan area, and because they're born and they live up there, they have a very, you know, rich supply of oxygen in their blood, which enables them to live in that high elevation area more easily than people at the lower elevations. But that's anybody who's a Sherpa, that's their last name. So you might have Dawa Sherpa or Nawang Sherpa or Karma Sherpa. But everyone in Nepal, their last name notes the caste that they're in. You can't choose to be a Sherpa if you're not born a Sherpa.
Jake, are you going back?
Oh, yeah, I'll be back.
Okay. When will you be able to go back, and how often do you think you can go?
I'm either going to go back with Jan here up in coming spring or going back in the summer to follow up on this future project for the Upper Mustang children. I want to try to go back at least twice a year just to maintain a presence.
Wow,
You build these relationships when you're over there with the people that help you do this good. And they become friends, you know, and you want to be able to follow up on your projects, make sure they're going good, and keep these relationships strong, because they help you get a lot done while you're over there, you know, or while you're not there as well.
Yeah. Jake, thanks very much. I'm glad you can join us. I admire you for doing this. I would encourage you to not only continue to do this, but I would encourage you to shake the bushes, because I believe there's an awful lot of people in all of our communities that that probably would love to be part of this if they were only asked, or at least it was shared with them what the value of doing it was. I think we tend to be more egocentric than we should be. And more effort that young people like you can put forth would be terrific, and I thank you for that.
Yes, you're welcome. Hey. Of course, it's important.
Yeah. You know? Anything I missed before you go that you want to share with us?
I think you covered it all. Okay. Just go to the Hands in Nepal website and check us out and look at all the projects and what we've been doing and what we have coming up.
Okay,
and
great.
Jake, before you go, you took some amazing photographs when you were over there and kept a really good blog. Can you tell people how to find your blog and look at those pictures?
Oh, yeah, it's on search Tumblr, and the username is use it as a username.
Okay.
So Or you can search for hands and heart.
Okay. Also, what we can do is if you work with Jan to talk to Christina, our producer, and what we can do is get the links for those on the KCBX website.
Sure. Sounds great.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much, Jake. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Yeah, she gives me basically, I've got to release him here, there we go, a chance to chat about that, and that is that there'll be an avenue for people to get in touch with your website. We can put it on the KCBX website.
Great.
It'll be tied to this program because all these programs are archived and it's easily searchable. I know sometimes we try and give out phone numbers and websites over the air, and it's kind of hard to track those down. So we'll make sure that information is on the kcbx.org website. And when you go to Central Coast Voices and find today's programs, we'll make sure those links are on there. They may not be on there today, but they'll be on there hopefully within a couple
of
days.
I always keep a blog when I'm in Nepal. And so if you wanted more details on what I do when I'm over there, or the little stories that I write about, like following street children around one day to see where they eat and how they live, you can go to my blog. I put pictures and writings. And Jake did a fabulous job this last trip with blogging about his encounters with you were talking about impressions when you get off the plane and you're in a place as exotic as old historic Kathmandu, and the first thing you usually see are naked sadhus wandering the streets, as well as Brahma bulls and monkeys, and just the colors and the senses, the incense, the bells ringing, you know, the temples. It's just an explosion on your senses. And he did some amazing pictures, put them on his blog, and wrote very descriptively about things he was seeing and experiencing.
We'll make sure we put some links to those on the website then. I want to get, Holly, I want to get back to something that you brought up, because you were talking about a trip that you did in Middle Eastern studies from UC Santa Barbara to Egypt about 10 years ago, I guess. And one of the things you talked about was basically a need for more schools for young girls. And it's been in the news a lot because of what's gone on in parts of Africa, a little bit less so in Asia, that there's a tremendous resistance in some cultures for girls to get educated. Some cultures are very proactive about it because they realize if you educate girls, you basically broaden the education of the whole community. But there's a tremendous resistance in parts of Africa to this. What is the response to that you experienced in Egypt with regard to the question of education for girls?
We visited a number of schools, and every school that we went to, the parents would meet us and we would sit in a circle and discuss their children's education. And the parents were all very pro-education for their girls. Because compulsory education is to third grade for girls, there's no real funding for anything after that. And so a lot of the NGOs and a lot of the U.S. aid at the time, were that was where the money was coming from. And these parents were just begging us to continue that funding for their girls, and we had parents crying and begging for us to continue the funding. We didn't have anything to do with the funding. We were just there as researchers and visiting various different schools. But there were a lot of grants at the time sending teachers from Egypt to the United States to learn various different teaching techniques. And we brought some of those techniques and shared them with them. I started a little cross-cultural education experience with one of the schools there and kept in contact with the teachers for a number of years. But it was always the same in that they lacked the funding for the upper education for girls. The boys, it was that they went on. But for girls, that funding had to come from someplace else.
Yeah. Is in Nepal, do they perceive it on a more gender-neutral level, or is there also more likelihood to educate the males and less likely to educate the girls?
I'm thinking that the girls have a little bit harder time, that the boys tend to go on to high school. Jan would be able to speak to this better.
The girls do have a harder time because, there's a couple of really interesting factors in girls attending school that I never thought about but were explained to us once we started meeting with the villagers. One is bathroom facilities. If there aren't bathroom facilities at a school, girls aren't allowed to attend. It's just not culturally acceptable for a girl to go to the bathroom out in the
find
field.
Find a tree, yeah.
Yeah, find a tree. Yeah,
it doesn't work for them.
So we started to say we would build a bathroom with every school. It wasn't that hard to do. You know, they use pit toilets in that part of the world, and it was basically just making a privacy barrier and with a door on it. The next factor is menstruation. When girls start to menstruate, they usually stop going to school. That's usually considered the time when they become a woman and they need to get married and start having babies. And that's just part of the rural cultural life in Nepal.
So high school is not an option for most girls.
Well,
then,
because of that, this is out in the villages. Now, down in the cities, like in Kathmandu, you reach a point with the government-run schools where you're faced with high school being a boarding school. You know, you have to pay and go to a boarding school if you want higher education. And for some of the families, if they have to choose between which child is going to produce the most money or get a job, they see the girl as somebody who's going to get married and leave the family. So they're going to go with the son to put money into his education because he is probably most likely to return money to the family. So in poor countries, it's not so much as, oh, we don't like girls, we like boys better. It's a matter of economics.
Well, I think Nepal has a reasonable amount of export for clothing that makes it to the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
And is most of that done in small factory or home type factories? And is it done mostly by men or women?
I'd say all the above. I've seen men working sewing machines,
okay.
But you definitely have hit on an important point with the economics there. It is a very textile-rich industry, and there are a lot of Nepali imports leaving the country. But one thing that I found is a way to help a woman is to give her a sewing machine, and that's something else we've been doing at Hands in Nepal. And not to get sidetracked off on sewing projects, but I often do bring back products that I find in women-run businesses over there in order to support them. And I try to interview and find women who are trying to start their own business to keep their children in school. So if they can have a viable way to earn a living through sewing, then their children don't need to work and they can go to school. Believe me, that is at the heart of every Nepali's parent I've met. They want their children to go to school. But if there isn't enough food on the table, if they're starving, they have to make choices. And you soon start to learn that education is a sort of a luxury, even though you try your best to convince them that in the long run, it's a necessity to be literate.
Go ahead, Holly.
I was going to say that one of my experiences being in Nepal with Jan was going to buy sewing machines. And if you can imagine, after a very long flight, I don't know, 40 hours or something to Nepal, getting up the next day and making it into the bazaar down to buy sewing machines, following Jan was, you know, you had to be as young as Jake, and I'm not. But, you know, we wanted to put a flag on her head so we could keep up with her and finally get to the place where the sewing machines were bought. And then seeing those sewing machines hauled on bicycles halfway through town, and again following the bikes and the sewing machines and just hustling. Jan did not stop one bit. The whole time she's there, she doesn't stop. She's like the Energizer bunny.
Okay.
She just keeps going and going.
Well, I'm curious. So my thought is the sewing machines become an enticement also. So if you can get people involved in doing things that they need a sewing machine for, you end up with a somewhat captive audience to maybe get them involved in literacy issues and education.
Exactly, exactly. And I have this fantasy of having enough money someday to actually have my own home over there where young girls can come and learn how to use a sewing machine and develop a business around tailoring or sewing. But at the same time, they can learn to read, they can learn business math, and they can learn enough skills through literacy to keep their books, have a business. Reading is crucial, you know, all those important things that are part of becoming a business owner. And this would just be a very exciting prospect to do. I have started looking into renting homes in Kathmandu, and it's not as cheap as you'd think. Most places yeah. are around $500 a month over there for a place that's sizable enough.
For the economy, that's 8 or 10 yeah. times the average monthly wage. So, yeah.
But that's the price of being in, you know, the biggest city in Nepal. So now we are starting to take sewing machines out to villages. And we took a machine out last time, and this next trip I'll be taking some more to the village where we have a school and a library. And I was telling them at that village that maybe they could use the library as a place to set up sewing machines in the evening so women can teach women how to sew and how to use them.
Well, that brings up another side question we may not have too much time to get into today, but I'm curious. So is the entire country pretty much electrified as far as electricity being available?
No. Because, these are treadle foot operated
okay,
machines.
Okay, that's what I thought.
There's electricity. And that, it's very
sketchy. I actually was surprised to see that's a big factor for schools. There's a couple of organizations that are involved in basically some national companies that do solar installations that have been involved in international school work, where they've basically said one of the things that's critical for the schools, they'll find schools that already exist in some communities uh-huh. in the world, but they have no electricity, mm-hmm. which means the kids get an education, but their parents don't get any. And they've talked about the fact that by electrifying schools with very, very simple, reasonably basic solar power units, they've been able to set the schools up to be used in the evenings, which is when parents can come to school yeah. to do things.
That's a great idea, yeah. but there's another factor involved, and that's the psychological component of adult education. That's something I've talked a lot about to these village friends in Nepal, that you're an adult, you can still learn. They don't see that as an option. It's like, no, I'm grown up. I work in the fields. I can't learn. And I've told them about how we have adult education in the U.S., mm-hmm. and this is another area that somebody can get into. But, you know, we get really passionate about what we're doing in Nepal, and I like to quote Mother Teresa, you know, if you can't feed 1,000, feed just one. So if you can't educate a whole entire populace, at least you can help a village. And they, in turn, will educate their children, and they, in turn, will educate their children, and you've started a movement. So the same thing goes with this concept of adult education. You know, maybe if we can convince some adults in a village that they can learn to read at this late stage in life, they will convince other adults. We do get solar lights, though, from the Rotary Club, and I really want to shout out to Eco Rotary and Morro Bay Rotary. They've consistently donated to our organization every year with solar lights that are from, do you remember, Holly, Unite to Light?
Right.
I think they're called Unite to Light, and every trip we take dozens of these solar lights over with us to the villages.
Yeah. Holly, we've got a few minutes left. This has obviously been a very important part of your life and a very touching experience to be part of. Is there something we haven't touched on here that you really would like to make sure everybody understands?
I think for me, in helping individuals, that it's really important that your help is very connected to them. And Jan has connected hands in such a way that there isn't a middle person. It's not just sending money. And to me, that's so important. The fact that she's been to Nepal 12 times. I've only been once. And that good that she is doing is beyond, you know, it's beyond belief that She goes and she works really hard. She travels up into these villages. She sleeps above buffaloes. She does
not boy choice.
Sleeping above buffaloes.
She's
okay.
In
that's a good title for a book. Sleeping above buffaloes.
Sleeping above buffaloes. Okay.
But anyway, just sitting in the circle of a community is an experience that, you know, they've plastered your head with red tikka, uh-huh. And your eyes are itching, but you're all smiles. You don't understand a word, but they love Jan, uh-huh. And they love hands.
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
I think this is a great example of you don't have to be a big multinational. You can be a small non-governmental agency, and that makes a big difference. Jan, what are your thoughts before we close today?
Well, you know, you've mentioned several times that I teach full time and I do this too, but it's when you love what you do, it's easy to do it. And I shouldn't use the word easy, because it's not easy to do what we do. It takes a lot of dedication and a lot of work and a lot of effort. We have this amazing board of directors, and every single person on our board, like Holly and Lee and Julie Bauer and Jamie Walker and a whole host of others, you know, that I'm forgetting right now, they work really, really hard to get the word out and raise money so that we can keep supporting our projects and doing what we're doing. And they do it because they believe in education. They believe that something like teaching a child how to read is going to change that child's life. And I've seen firsthand that it does. Giving girls in poor countries a choice between do you want to get married or do you want to stay in school is just a wonderful gift to give, you know, a young woman. It can be a choice. And having the opportunity to go to Nepal, I feel privileged. I feel really, really privileged to have this time in my life to spend in such a unique and amazing part of our world. And I just love sharing it. So thank you, Fred, again, for letting us share that on Central Coast Voices with all our neighbors here on the Central Coast.
Yeah, and your relatives from as far away from
Florida.
And
yes, well, my dear brother, who I love so much, Jim, thank you for calling in. Okay. And to my nephew, Jake, you know, for his efforts and going over there. Yeah. And now the passion's ignited in him, too. And to anybody else who wants to join us or go over with me, please use the contact information, and we're happy to share what we're doing.
I think it's very admirable that something that started out by a college student's crusade project became so involved here, and I thank you both for joining us. This has been a fascinating program, talking about Hands in Nepal, a wonderful small nonprofit NGO, non-governmental agency based in Santa Margarita, California. I want to let you know, you probably know this is Central Coast Voices, and next week, Chris Kington Barker will be with you, and she's going to talk about the Affordable Care Act along with mental health and substance abuse issues, because under the Affordable Care Act, there is finally coverage that expands it greatly after some modifications. And prior to the Affordable Care Act, over one-third of the individuals who had health insurance had no coverage for substance abuse work, and or 20% had no coverage for any kind of mental health work. And so many individuals fell through the cracks, even if they had insurance. This has been something the Affordable Care Act has helped with. How well is the additions to the Affordable Care Act working for these patients? Are they receiving the kind of treatment they want, and does the coverage really cover it? Chris Kington Barker will be with us next week, and she's going to be joined by Jill Bolster White, who's the executive director of Transitions Mental Health, and Ann Robin, who is the behavioral health administrator for the County of San Luis Obispo, and Sarah Kress, who's the mental health director for community health centers. And they're going to look at the importance of these kind of things in our health care in our community and how they're affected by the Affordable Care Act. As I've told you many times before, I'll tell you again, this is Central Coast Voices, sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX. And I want to add to that in the new year that it's also made possible through underwriting by Joan Gilbert, Sargent, who is a wonderful member of our community that is helping us with all of this. Your input from about Central Coast Voices and the work of Action is important to all of us. You can give us an email shout at voices@kcbx.org or call us at 543-2323. Thank you to Jan and Holly today and Jake by phone and the work that Hands in Nepal does. This has been Central Coast Voices, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Fred. Namaste.